Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we need to continue our appeals to heaven. And I would ask that you continue to learn, and you continue to pray, and most importantly, you get up off your knees and act. We need people actually doers, you know, not just of the word, but doers of the word. Anyway, with that, our focus is on the constitutional compliance. It's about setting up constitutional compliance committees, holding our public service accountable to every part of the Constitution. We must oppose every infraction. And the final point is that we try to bring forward are these things called electors. I'm willing to throw my hat in the ring as an official candidate as President of the United States. Now, I could get selected as vice president because the electors are the ones that choose us to do that. So I may not get selected as president because the electors choose, but I'm looking for you to actually run your campaign on being an elector in your congressional district. You can demand that your state allow you to be on the ballot to be the elector, a formal elector, to actually choose the president. The fact that the states are allowing the parties to control the Electoral College is absolutely unacceptable. The Constitution does not allow the parties to do that. Oh, well, everybody's okay with it. They're getting, you know, they're all going along with it. Isn't that okay? Which is why we have popular vote. This is why we're slipping into the abyss. Anyway, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And we are in the throes of the Massachusetts debates. And let me see here. Where did we leave off? I think there was one paragraph left over from Mr. Bowden that you didn't get through because that was kind of a long dissertation. It was probably 2 pages?
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Oh, easily.
It was pretty long.
It was 2 pages. So anyway, all right. So go ahead.
Okay, if we consider the objects of the power, they are numerous and important, and as human foresight cannot extend to many of them, and all of them are in the womb of futurity, the quantum of the power cannot be estimated. Less than the whole, as relative to federal purposes, may, through its insufficiency, occasion in the dissolution of the Union and a subjugation or division of it among foreign powers. Their attention is drawn to the United States. Their emissaries are watching our conduct, particularly upon the present most important occasion, and if we should be so unhappy as to reject the federal constitution proposed to us and continue much longer our present weak, unenergetic federal government, their policy will probably induce them to plan a division or partition of the states among themselves and unite their forces to effect it.
Emissaries, those are ambassadors that are representing another sovereign, potent state, what have you, like a king. I mean, throughout Europe, it was monarchs at the time, and they would send emissaries. Nowadays, if it's presidents or what have you, they're ambassadors, but it's typically the same thing. And so they're just those people there to kind of do deals with trade, you know, and maintain relations. So that was kind of, if you look at how government was going, if you looked at the maturity of government in Asia, the only reason that emissaries were even, you know, in this international relationship where there would be emissaries in a nation from other nations, it was just common in Europe. It wasn't common in Asia. It's not common in Africa or South America. It only became common because of Western civilization. Because maintaining, I'll just say, ties, ambassador ties, and having embassies so that you can deal directly with that state's representative, because the whole point of these ambassadors is to deal with the president over foreign affairs or with the king, whoever has that authority. So this is Western society growing, because as we look at this point in time, it was only the European nations. But today, everybody has an ambassador and everybody wants to play in the international game, even though there are a lot of states that are that have less wealth and less power than a county in the United States. So anyway, let's move on. So that was Mr. Thompson going through that. And as he goes down a little bit further, he actually dives into specifically delegated. That was taxation and the failing of the Confederation. Now he's going to say, you know, a few words on delegation. And if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and read this, because anyway, you don't mind, do you?
No, I don't care.
Okay. It will be, and has been said, this great power may be abused. We heard that all the time, just recently in this debate. And instead of protecting, may be employed in Congress in oppressing their constituents. A possibility of abuse, as it may be affirmed, of all delegated power, whatever, is by itself no sufficient reason for withholding the delegation. If it were sufficient, one, no power could be delegated, nor could government of any sort subsist. The possibility, however, should make us careful that in all delegations of importance, like the one contained in the proposed Constitution, that there should be checks provided as would not frustrate the end and intention of delegating the power, but would, as far as it could be safely done, prevent the abuse of it. And such checks are provided in the Constitution. Some of them were mentioned in the last evening by one of the many worthy colleagues, but I shall here exhibit all of them in one view. The two capital departments of government, the legislative and executive, in which the delegated power resides, consisting of the president, vice president, senate, and representatives, are directly and respectively legislatures and delegates chosen by the people. Now, I'm going to pipe in on this, because technically, the president or the executive in America only has very limited legislative power. That limited legislative power is to a negative power. In other words, he can't create law, but he can veto law. That makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Now, we get into the oath. Go ahead. I'll let you carry the ball there.
The president and also the vice president, when acting as president, before they enter on the execution of the office, shall each solemnly swear or affirm that he will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. The senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the state legislatures and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution.
Okay, so actually he quoted that out of Article 6. So that right there, the senators, representatives, that was all a part of the required, legally required oath of everybody else. Okay, and then the next quote is what?
The president and vice president and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors.
Okay, and then he uses the next quote. So what he's doing right here is he's actually reading these parts of the Constitution, right? So, okay. So the next quote is what? Title of nobility?
No senator.
No. You're right. No senator. Go ahead.
Yeah. No senator or representative shall, during the time for which he was elected, be appointed to any civil office which shall have been created, or the emoluments whereof shall have been increased during such time, and no person holding any office under the United States shall be a member of either house during his continuance in office.
Okay, so an emolument is what? An emolument is like a pay. It's money. Mm-hmm. It's a benefit. In other words, if you do this, you'll get this. Like you'll have access to free food or health care or what have you, right? It is a benefit while you're in office. In other words, an emolument is some form of compensation for service. Go ahead. Title of nobility.
The next quote. No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States or by any particular state, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state.
Yeah, and see, it's present, like a Christmas present.
Except of any present.
Okay. So the way... When people read that, that present kind of throws them off because they're not thinking that a person would just give them a gift. But that's exactly what that is. Except of any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, from a king, what have you. So, in other words, they can't be beholding. You know, I'm gonna buy your dinner. That's a present, right? I mean, so... Most
do that all the time.
Yeah. Actually, they have rules. If you're going out with a legislator in the federal or this in your state and you buy them dinner, they're supposed to report that because they can't accept a dinner that's of a certain anything that's less than $25 value. I think that's the federal government limitation on a gift, you know, as long as it's not a costly gift. But if you go back to when they instituted that, that's back in the days where $25 was a pretty decent meal. You're lucky to go through, you know, McDonald's today with $25.
Yeah.
So, I'm just trying to help as we as we list these things. So, because again, he's quoting the Constitution. All right, go ahead. The next one.
Okay, next quote. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republic form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion and domestic violence.
So here we actually see he's kind of going all over the place because the oath of office was in Article 6. Then the presidential oath was in Article 2. So he's basically cherry picking out these different sections of the Constitution because this last one, the guarantee clause that you just read, that's out of Article 4. Okay, so go ahead. Okay. And now he's not quoting.
Okay, to these great checks may be added several other very essential ones, as the negative which each house has upon the acts of the other, the disapproving power of the president, which subjects those acts to revision by the two houses and to a final negative, unless 2/3 of each house shall agree to pass the returned acts, notwithstanding the president's objections, the printing the journals of each house containing their joint and respective proceedings, and the publishing from time to time a regular statement and account of receipts and expenditures of all public money, none of which shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law.
And technically that should have been quoted as well, but it was kind of more paraphrased, I guess. Anyway. Now he gets into delegated. So if we go down to the next page, we got this little section with some green highlights. Here we go.
Okay. You want me to do the green?
No. Go ahead and just read the whole thing.
Okay. All these checks and precautions provided in the Constitution must in great measure prevent an abuse of power, at least in all flagrant instances, even if Congress should consist wholly of men who were guided by no other principle than their own interests. Under the influence of such checks, this would compel them to conduct which in the general would answer the intention of the Constitution. But the presumption is, and if the people duly attend to the objects of their choice, it would be realized that the President of the United States and the members of Congress would for the most part be men not only of ability but of good moral character, in which case an abuse of power is not to be apprehended, nor any error in the government, but such as every human institution is subject to.
Right. I think the key word here, if the people duly attend to the objects of their choice, it would be realized. Because right there, what that means is if we actually hold them accountable to these limitations. Go ahead. Now, down here, okay. He gets into delegated, because this is where I kind of skipped over this. I apologize. Probably confused you. Here's where he goes into the delegated powers right here.
Okay. With regard to rights, the whole Constitution is a declaration of rights, which primarily and principally respect the general government intended to be formed by it. The rights of particular states or private citizens not being the object or subject of the Constitution, they are only incidentally mentioned. In regard to the former, it would require a volume to describe them as they extend to every subject of legislation, not included in the powers vested in Congress, and in regard to the latter, as all governments are founded on the relinquishment of personal rights in a certain degree, there was a clear impropriety in being very particular about them. By such a particularity, the government might be embarrassed and prevented from doing what the private as well as the public and general good of the citizens and states might require. The public good, in which private is necessarily involved, might be hurt by too particular an enumeration, and the private good could suffer no injury from a deficient enumeration, because Congress could not injure the rights of private citizens without injuring their own, as they must, in their public as well as their private character, participate equally with others in the consequence of their own acts.
Okay.
And by this most important circumstance, in connection with the checks above mentioned, the several states at large, and each citizen in particular, will be secured as far as human wisdom can secure them against the abuse of the delegated power.
Okay, so once again, they point out that Congress cannot immune themselves from anything they inflict upon the people. Right there it says, Congress could not injure the rights of private citizens without injuring their own, as they must, in their public as well as private character, participate equally with others in the consequences of their own acts.
Yeah, Congress should have to pay for all their own health insurances like we do.
They should not be able to tax us to pay for theirs. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, bottom line, there shouldn't be any health care, national health care, and they shouldn't have their own health care. They shouldn't have their own retirement. There's no such thing as a national retirement system other than Social Security. But they participate in that as well. But they've immune themselves from that because they understand that they should have, because they've risen above the minions and the people, that they have to have something better.
Social Security stinks, so...
But yeah,
themselves much better.
Yes, but that's the point. Here, they're literally saying that they cannot immune themselves from it, and they are, and they have been.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's twice we have seen the Congress immuning themselves or not submitting themselves to the same things. So we've got about 6 minutes left. So let's go down to Mr. Taylor, who has a complaint.
Okay. Mr. Taylor said the consideration of the 8th section had taken up a great deal of time. That gentleman had repeated the same arguments over and over again, and although the order of the convention was that the proposed constitution should be considered by paragraphs, he was pleased, he said, to observe that the honorable gentleman, fast speaking, had gone into the matter at large, and therefore he hoped that other gentlemen would take the same liberty, and that all further observations might be on the system at large.
Okay, so in other words, here's a complaint that the hyperbole from all of these other guys that kept on saying the same things over and over and over again. In other words, they're not the best argument is a reinforced argument. If your argument didn't land, give you the outcome that you were looking for, then you reinforce it, you support it with more data, with more information, more details. These guys kept on saying, well, we got to have a Bill of Rights. We got to have a Bill of Rights. And everybody in that room started recognizing that, you know what, we really don't need a Bill of Rights because this actually contains the specific powers. They can't meddle with all these other things. Why would we need a Bill of Rights? This is why these states literally ratified these things. Now, we're coming up to a point where we find, I think, the Honorable Mr. Hancock is going to kind of speak, but that's just a few, maybe a day away. So let's keep going, though. And so the next one is this oath and religious tests. Go ahead.
Mr. Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
It has been objected that the Constitution provides no religious test by oath. We may have in power unprincipled men, atheists, and pagans. No man can wish more ardently than I do that all our public offices may be filled by men who fear God and hate wickedness, but it must remain with the electors to give the government this security. An oath will not do it. Will an unprincipled man be entangled by an oath? Good point. Will an atheist or a pagan dread the vengeance of the Christian's God, a being, in his opinion, the creature of fancy and credulity?
Credulity.
It is, yeah.
Okay, keep going.
It is a solecism, an expression.
Right.
No man is so illiberal as to wish the confining places of honor or profit to any one sect of Christians. What security is it to the government that every public officer shall swear that he is a Christian? For what will then be called Christianity? One man will declare that the Christian religion is only an illumination of natural religion, and that he is a Christian. Another Christian will assert that all men must be happy hereafter, in spite of themselves. A third Christian reverses the image and declares that, let a man do all he can, he will certainly be punished in another world. And a fourth would tell us that if a man use any force for the common defense, he violates every principle of Christianity. Sir, the only evidence we can have of the sincerity of a man's religion is a good life. And I trust that such evidence will be required of every candidate by every elector. The man who acts an honest part to his neighbor will most probably conduct honorably towards the public. Good.
There you go. Okay, so let me read down through the red. It has been objected, because this is, he continues on and says, it has been objected that we have not a good security against abuse of power under the new Constitution as the Confederation gives us. It is my deliberate opinion that we have a better security. Under the Confederation, the whole power, executive, legislative, is vested in one body in which the people have no representation, and where the states, the large and the small, are equally represented, and all the checks and states have is a power to remove and disgrace of an unfaithful servant after the mischiefs is perpetrated. Under this Constitution, an equal representation immediately from the people is introduced by who they negative and the exclusive right of originating money bills, have the power to control the Senate, where the sovereignty of the states is represented. But it is objected that in the old Confederation, the states could at any time recall their delegates, and there was a rotation. Actually, one of the problems that came out of the Articles of Confederation is that many of the states were not even sending delegates anymore. They couldn't afford it. They couldn't afford to put somebody out there. That's why they were using proxies with other state representatives and so forth. And the system was literally dying. It was in its last gasp for air when the Constitution finally came out. And Congress was literally sitting there with their fingers and legs and toes all crossed, hoping that this Constitution would be ratified so that the Union could be preserved. So, anyway, we're going to be going into a break. This is good stuff, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because we're hearing these guys actually explain things that, you know, it makes sense. I mean, it, you know, like immuning themselves from their own laws. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But they've created a system that they're doing that. But there's nowhere in the Constitution.
Yeah.
There's nowhere in the Constitution that allows them to do that. That's the point. That's the point there. So we've got more of the Massachusetts debates. And so when we come back, this is going to be a few pages, but it will be uninterrupted from another promo, so we got to take a quick break. With that, we will be right back after the promo. Thank you so much, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we're still going through the ratification debates, and we got, this is Mr. Parsons, and we're still on Wednesday, January 23rd. We've got a few to go through here. Have you looked ahead, Tammy? And you may want to unmute yourself, but if you look ahead.
Yes, I did look ahead.
And so it's a little reading. But let's get this knocked out of the park, because here's somebody that's really helping people understand the details of the Constitution. So right there, you start off with no essential benefit could be derived. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay, no essential benefit could be derived to the people from these provisions, but great inconveniences will result from them. It has been observed by a gentleman who has argued against the Constitution that a representative ought to have an intimate acquaintance with the circumstances of his constituents, and, after comparing them with the situation of every part of the Union, so conduct as to promote the common good. The sentiment is an excellent one and ought to be engraved on the hearts of every representative. But what is the effect of the power of recalling? Your representative with an operating revocation over his head will lose all ideas of the general good and will dwindle to a servile agent, attempting to serve local and partial benefits by cabal and intrigue. There are great and insuperable objections to a rotation. It is an abridgment of the rights of the people, and it may deprive them at critical seasons of the services of the most important characters in the nation. It deprives a man of honorable ambition, whose highest duty is the applause of his fellow citizens, of an efficient motive to great and patriotic exertions. The people individually have no method of testifying their esteem but by a re-election, and shall they be deprived of the honest satisfaction of wreathing for their friend and patriot a crown of laurel more durable than monarchy can bestow.
Okay, so he's kind of pointing out that this, putting it into the hands of the people every 2 years, is a better system than just a rotation or, you know, a fixed term and term limits. As a matter of fact, the framers, most all of the framers, were against term limits. They thought that that was repugnant to the will of the people. That if you create a term limit system, then you actually, it's your loss. It's a greater loss. If you want control over your government, you have to keep them in check, period. If you're using term limits to actually be your effective stop guard to say, okay, well, you know, this guy's going to damage us for the 8 years he's going to be in office, for his four terms as a representative, but at least he can only do 8 years of damage. No. You should elect a man of good character and hold him accountable. Every day, every year, he's in office. The concept of term limits is, it's like, well, you know, we can't sit and watch the children, so we'll just create these walls to put around the children so that they can't hurt themselves or they can't go beyond that. Well, I mean, they could still get hurt within that containment area, right? And so giving them very, not just walls, but very, you can only do these things instead of letting them do anything and everything they can do in that space. No. Holding government accountable. That is the key. That's, I think, that was...
Those are good points, because there are a few people who ran on term limits, so...
Yeah, and you know what? Maybe those people don't have good ideas. Maybe those people aren't really good for public service. Madison spent his whole life in public service. Had there been term limits, then Madison may not have made it to president or made it, you know, within the House of Representatives as long as he was. So, and if you look at John Quincy Adams, after president, he went and served the Senate. And he spent the rest of his
life. Well, there's also people like Ron Paul who just kept getting reelected and reelected.
Yes. And that's, it needs to be in the hands of the people. The people should be making the decisions. You can't create barriers. You know what a governor is? Now, most people, when I say, you know what a governor is a restriction. Because a governor in politics may be the executive of a state. But if you use a governor on your accelerator, that means that your accelerator cannot go past a certain point to where you can't accelerate beyond that point. You can't, you know, go faster. These governors are put in as safety measures to keep people from going too fast or accelerating too fast. Most cars today have traction control, so you can't deliberately spin your tires and smoke out everybody. In governing or in our representation in government, we shouldn't need to have those types of things. If the necessity is to go faster because we need to get there, then, you know, having a governor could be fatal in your car or in your government, not being allowed to do something. Now, I understand the limit, the enumerated powers, but whatever those enumerated powers are, you shouldn't create limitations like you can only be there for 2 years. What could actually happen is somebody could actually be deeply engaged in some really good endeavors at the state level and, you know, be literally knocked out and it just dies because nobody has the vision, nobody has the leadership that that person's bringing to the table. It needs to constantly be weighed by the people whether that person goes back into office or not. By creating a hard barrier, it is more problematic. And it actually stifles, you know, good government. It just basically says, because the only reason you have those governors or those restrictions is because, well, the government's bad. No, government's not bad. Government can do great things. Not at our expense, but they can do things. They can actually help grow by getting out of our way, removing, you know, these restrictions. Like, you know, when other states are playing around and saying, well, you know, we're not going to buy your goods or what have you. You need to have a good governor that actually says, hey, you can't stop our stuff from selling in your state. You're violating the Commerce Clause. That's a good thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because the fact that the Wyoming governor, Governor Gordon, is... I'll keep it clean. He is not doing his job because he has failed to defend Wyoming's right to sell coal through international ports, because the whole western states will not allow Wyoming coal to be shipped out those ports. That's a violation of the Constitution. And so having a weak governor is your problem. You need to have a good governor. You don't need to put in term limits, because bottom line, if we look at just term limits as solving the problem, it doesn't. Oh, well, at least, you know, we'll have to put up with this guy for 4 years, 8 years, whatever. No, we have to hold them accountable and make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. It's a self-governing system. They're just our representatives. And if they don't like the fact that they're representing us, then don't run for re-election. You know, Have you ever dealt with somebody that is a backseat driver or a, you know, a chef, you know, directing, you know, what to do in the kitchen? Have you ever dealt with somebody that, you know, is constantly telling you what you should be doing?
Oh, sure.
Okay. A lot of fun, isn't it?
Not really.
Not really. But if that person is, I mean, let's just say, you know, I don't know, Chef Boyardee. You know, you got Chef Boyardee and they're, you know, you're doing stuff and, you know, and if he's a good chef, he probably won't even say anything and he probably will eat the food as presented. But that's what good chefs do, these egotistical people. But, I mean, wouldn't you want to actually say, well, you know, hey, I'm cooking a meal. Would you mind helping? No, empower people. 9 times out of 10, though, when the backseat driver, all they're trying to do is they're trying to control the execution of the mode of transportation, and you know, instead of you. Oh, there's a light coming. The light's turning green. The point is this, is that the person that's behind the wheel is behind the wheel. If that person says, you know what, why don't you drive? Then great. It's my car, I drive. Then sometimes when you're trying to be the backseat driver, that doesn't help. You know, and, you know, like with a child, 9 times out of 10, if you constantly direct the child while they're trying to learn how to drive, you kind of have to do that. But you got to start learning when they have to make their own decisions. And constant direction is, you know, it's good up front in the very beginning with on-the-job training at the beginning stuff. But after a while, you got to let them make the mistakes. Maybe not fatal ones, but you got to let them learn to drive, right?
Yeah.
I'll give you a good case in point. Mm-hmm. Young men want to drive a car. I went down a rat hole. If you just said rat hole, you're right. Young men, when they like driving, they like to put their foot to the floor and take off, you know. And over time, a young man's going to realize that he's spending a lot of money on gas because he's just consuming it more, and he's probably spending more money on his brakes, and his maintenance of his car is going to go up. But they have to learn their lesson, right? And if we make a world to where there is no lessons learned, you're just in bubble wrap and you can't go too fast, you know, it's just like, you know, instead of driving on a road, just put me into a, what are those things you put the tube in and it just gets sucked to the...
So what about the term limit for the president?
So I have a problem with that. I have a problem with the term limit for the president. The problem with FDR was FDR had a political system that was basically controlling. The parties themselves were controlling the politics. If we had a true political system, FDR would not have probably been reelected because it was a popular vote and the party controlled it. And the party made sure that FDR kept on getting reelected. I don't even think FDR would have been elected had we followed the Electoral College.
Yeah.
Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. You know, any president could have done more than 2 terms. It was just an honorary thing. Washington stepped down after 2 terms. Why? Because he was old. He was going to die. And he did die in Adams' term, the following term. So, you know, Adams served, but he didn't step down. Washington unseated him. Or not Washington, Jefferson. And then Jefferson did 2 terms, and he lived a while. I mean, shoot, he lived a couple, almost 2 decades beyond his stepping down from president. And Madison lived several decades, almost, yeah, 2 decades beyond when he stepped down, because he died, what, in 1837, and he stepped down in 1817? So that's 2 decades. Yeah, so anyway, the idea of term limits, it does not serve anything other than it feeds the fear that everybody's bad. Instead of,
right,
we have a job to make sure that they do their job. These are the checks and balances. We, the people, have to hold these people accountable. These aren't...
So Washington was only 67 when he died.
I know. But he had teeth problems, right? Mm-hmm. And so people that have dental problems usually don't live as long.
Yeah.
There's, I mean, certain things really do affect your living, the duration of your life. And dental is definitely one of those. You know, there's a lot, those old people that are, you know, most of those people that are really, really old in the old folks' home, you know, the ones the family mm-hmm. got rid of because they hadn't died yet. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be mean. 9 times out of 10, the people that are living the really long lives are the ones that are bragging that they still have their own teeth. Right?
I never thought about it that way, but she probably.
Yes, because they've taken care of themselves. And so that means that the other people that didn't take care of themselves, they marginalized basic hygiene and those types of things. It takes a toll on your health. Anyway, let's keep going.
Okay. It has been objected that the Senate are made too dependent on the state legislatures. No business under the Constitution of the Federal Convention could have been more embarrassing than constructing the Senate, as the body must conduct our foreign negotiations and establish and preserve a system of national politics, a uniform adherence to which can alone induce other nations to negotiate with and confide in us. It is certain the change of men who compose it should not be too frequent and should be gradual. At the same time, suitable checks should be provided to prevent an abuse of power and to continue their dependence on their constituents. I think the convention have most happily extricated themselves from the embarrassment. Although the senators are elected for 6 years, yet the Senate as a body composed of the same men can exist only for 2 years without the consent of the states. If the states think proper, 1/3 of that body may at the end of every second year be new men. When the Senate act as legislators, they are controllable at all times by the representatives, and in their executive capacity in making treaties and conducting the national negotiations, the consent of 2/3 is necessary. Who must be united to a man, which is hardly possible, or to the new men biennially sent to the Senate. If the states choose it, can control them, and at all times there will also be 1/3 of the Senate who at the expiration of 2 years must obtain a re-election or return to the mass of the people. And the change of men in the Senate will be so gradual as not to destroy or disturb any national system of politics.
Okay, he's talking about the classes, right? You know, the very first Senate was set up that 1/3 of the senators would be identified as a re-election in 2 years. The other third mm-hmm. was identified to be re-elected in 4 years. And the other third got to serve their full 6 years. And then when they get re-elected, they will serve a full 6-year term, ensuring that only 1/3, if at all, the only disruption that the Senate will feel is 1/3 of them being completely replaced. Because if you really think about the volatility of, you know, an entire legislative body, that in some cases you could literally do a wholesale get rid of all of them. Well, they realized that the Senate, you couldn't do that because they were they're constantly in negotiations of trade and constantly in negotiations of, you know, those things that have international ramifications. So anyway, okay, let's keep going. Go ahead.
It is objected that it is dangerous to allow the Senate a right of proposing alterations or amendments in money bills, that the Senate may by this power increase the supplies and establish profuse salaries, that for these reasons the Lords in the British Parliament have not this power, which is a great security to the liberties of Englishmen. I was much surprised at hearing this objection and the grounds upon which it was supported. The reason why the Lords have not this power is founded on a principle in the English Constitution that the Commons alone represent the whole property of the nation. And as a money bill is a grant to the king, none can make the grant but those who represent the property of the nation. And the negative of the Lords is introduced to check the profusion of the Commons and to guard their own property. The manner of passing the money bill is conclusive evidence of these principles, for after the assent of the Lords, it does not remain with the clerk of the Parliament, but is returned to the Commons, who by their Speaker present it to the King as the gift of the Commons. But every supposed control the Senate by this power may have over money bills, they can have without it, for by private communications with the representatives, they may as well insist upon the increase of the supplies or salaries as by official communications. But had not the Senate this power, the representatives might take any foreign matter to a money bill and compel the Senate to concur or lose the supplies. This might be done in critical seasons when the Senate might give way to the encroachments of the representatives rather than sustain the odium of embarrassing the affairs of the nation. The balance between the two branches of the legislature would, in this way, be endangered, if not destroyed, and the Constitution materially injured. This subject was fully considered by the Convention for forming the Constitution of Massachusetts, and the provision made by that body after mature deliberation is introduced into the federal Constitution.
Okay, so obviously there are these, the checks and balances, because that's really what he's talking about. He's basically saying the representatives in England of the people, which is the House of Commons, basically makes that when they're going to tax the people, it needs to come from the people. So the representatives have to basically say, okay, we're bequeathing upon the king this money, you know, leveraging our property. That's the same thing with the House of Representatives when it comes down to taxation. Now, taxation is only directive to the expenditure. So when we look at the Constitution, the money, the financial side of this should actually be focused on what they are supposed to do. Mm-hmm. Not what they want to do, what they're supposed to do. If they are doing something that they don't have the power to do, then they shouldn't do it. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, because we talked about this on a petition, right? Is taxation the problem? Taxation is never the problem. It's the spending. Why are they raising taxes? Because they're spending recklessly. They're spending money on things they have no authority to spend. We don't need hard, fixed taxes. We need government to be able to do those things that they're delegated to do. And that's it. That may change over time. Maybe a drought or a lack of lumber for building supplies or what have you may cost a little more between different factors in the market space. But bottom line, government does not have the power, nor I don't see any government in the United States legitimately having the power to just make up what they want to spend money on. And yet that's exactly what they're doing. They don't have the power mm-hmm. to do it. They're just doing it. And so what is the process? It always goes back to this, folks. You have to take a stand and hold them accountable. You have to say, you don't have the authority to do that. Now, this next paragraph is kind of short. We got 4.5 minutes. I think we can get through this one.
Okay. It was objected that by giving Congress a power of direct taxation, we give them power to destroy the state governments by prohibiting them from raising any monies. But this objection is not founded in the Constitution. Congress have only a concurrent right with each state in laying direct taxes, not an exclusive right, and the right of each state to direct taxation is equally extensive and perfect as the right of Congress. Any law, therefore, of the United States for securing to Congress more than a concurrent right with each state is usurpation and void.
Okay.
It has been,
we can get this last one because this is short too. Go ahead.
Okay. It has been objected that we have no Bill of Rights. If gentlemen who make this objection would consider what are the supposed inconveniences resulting from the want of a Declaration of Rights, I think they would soon satisfy themselves that the objection has no weight. Is there a single natural right we enjoy uncontrolled by our own legislature that Congress can infringe? Not one. Is there a single political right secured to us by our Constitution against the attempts of our own legislature which we are deprived of by this Constitution? Not one that I recollect. All the rights Congress can control, we have surrendered to our own legislature, and the only question is whether the people shall take from their own legislatures a certain portion of the several sovereignties and unite them in one head for the more effectual securing of the national prosperity and happiness.
Yeah, and it just goes down to this, I think, the argument of you're going to create government. You need a national government. Well, what's the most expensive thing that government can do? Fighting a war, right? I mean, the cost is unimaginable. The human capital that's lost in a war is just unimaginable. There's no yeah. money in the world that could, you know, could pay for that. So the ultimate cost that has to be done in preserving liberty, preserving sovereignty, and basically preserving life itself sometimes has to be war, which is, I mean, I can't imagine the federal Constitution not being granted the ability to declare war. The real question is, what is the purpose of declaring war? And if you really look at it, we have declared war and we have declared military actions that are outside of the Constitution constantly. Constantly. Mm-hmm. When we went into Vietnam, when we everywhere we've gone. Now, there is this assertion that the president has executive authority to exercise military action if, you know, there's an imminent danger for American interests or what have you. So there is the argument for that, because bottom line, you can't get Congress to actually make the decision fast enough to be able to, for the president to mm-hmm. actually do something. Thomas Jefferson was the first president to actually do something without congressional approval, sending the Marines into Tripoli and recovering the men, the cargo, and so forth. And so that's, he made that choice to do that. And even though it wasn't an act of war, it was still something that was reasonable for him to do in protecting American interests. When I talk about, and I really quick, America is only the police of the sea for our commerce. The fact that the rest of the world enjoys an open, free flow of commerce over the sea is because of us. And so as far as I'm concerned, had we basically said, you know, if you attack our ship, we'll come after you with the wrath of God, but you can attack every other ship. Had we done that, and had the pirates and everybody else started playing those games to start sinking all these other ships, then I think maybe those other nations would have been more than happy to start basically piping in to say, you know what, we want to cover this, because this is a big burden for you guys to make these channels of commerce to flow. We want to help contribute to that because we want to enjoy those channels of free-flowing commerce. I think that's where it should have been, and that's what we need to do. But anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.